Hi, I hope you're having a good day. This is Kim Harden, and I am reading the Decatur Herald and Review today, Friday, June the 20th, 2025. I always like to start with the weather, and as you probably know or will remember when I tell you, today is the summer solstice, June 20th, and it is the longest day of the year. The regional outlook indicates mostly sunny and humid today. Expect more than 10 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity 60% and good drying conditions. Clear, warm, and humid tonight. Average humidity of 70%. The high will be 87 degrees. The low tonight will be 74. South-southwest winds 8 to 16 miles an hour. Saturday, sunny, windy, and humid with wind in the 10 to 20 range. The high is 94 and the low is 75. On Sunday, hot, 8 to 16 mile an hour winds, high 97, 75 for the low, and it will be sunny all day. And Monday will be sunny all day, hot with sunshine, wind 7 to 14, 96 for the high, and 74 for the low. And for those of you with allergies, the tree and weed pollen is low today, the grass pollen is high, and the mold is moderate. We also have moderate air quality. And let's move on to the headlines for today. The opening page is a picture of a tornado alert siren off of West Pershing Road next to the Pershing Early Learning Center, taken on Tuesday, June the 10th. It is one of more than 20 sirens that go off simultaneously in the city when a warning is issued. The title of the story by Tony Reed is "Decatur's Emergency Warning System Activates When Threat Enters Its Boundaries." The city of Decatur has traditionally taken a shotgun approach to trying to save your life. The city's tornado alert sirens, more than 20 of them, are now linked to an automated system that triggers them simultaneously when the National Weather Service, NWS, issues a warning for a storm front that looks like it could threaten the community. This shotgun method of firing off all sirens all at once created a little confusion recently, with some residents commenting on social media that they looked out the window and did not see a threat in their immediate neighborhood. Matt Newell, the City of Decatur's Public Works Director, said the superfast computer-controlled trigger system is a relatively new development and came online in June of 2024. But, he added, whether people have noticed it before or not, the sirens have been sounding off together for decades, even when it was a human finger on the activation button. Well, I've been involved in maintaining the sirens for 35 years, and they've always, all of them, gone off together, Newell added. Tammy Schneider, the coordinator for the Macon County Emergency Management Agency, said the shotgun way makes sense. She believes that any time a tornado might be twisting its way anywhere close to where you live, it's far better to be made aware of it. If there is a tornado somewhere in or around the city, it's probably a good idea to know about that and to seek more information, said Schneider. We also recommend people having a NOAA weather alert radio in their house and wireless emergency alerts activated on their phones. One such system, for example, is the Macon County Emergency Alert and Notification System. The city's automated warning system is activated when an NWS polygon, the odd-sided box shape weather forecasters draw around a tornado warning area, brushes up against a geofence, a boundary encircling Decatur. This isn't a physical fence with guard towers, but a form of computer software tied to a map. When the advancing polygon touches the geofence, the sirens get triggered. No season. Schneider likes the slick way the city's system operates and says the whole of Macon County is in the process of being geofenced too, an undertaking that should be completed later this year. The county will be broken into geofenced zones, taking in some 25 warning sirens, not counting the ones in Decatur, activated zone by affected zone, and not, of course, going off all at once all over the much wider area of the county. Schneider said the new geofences won't come online a moment too soon, as she keeps a wary eye on tornado season that no longer seems to have a particular season. We have had tornadoes in all the months now. We've seen tornadoes happen in October and November and December, and even in January. So I am concerned with being able to effectively warn our citizens regardless of what time of year it is. The question arises, however, as to how much warning is too much warning. The meteorologists at the NWS have actually pondered this question. That's what social science would tell us, that there's a sweet spot on when to give people information and when folks would reasonably take action with that information, said Mike Albano, one of the meteorologists based at the NWS office in Lincoln. He said warnings in a range of 10 to 15 minutes work well in conveying an immediate sense of urgency while giving people time to seek shelter. He said current technology can achieve those warning times, but tornadoes remain forever capable of spinning off nasty surprises despite all the modern systems watching out for them. Tornadoes are just something that can come together very quickly, Albano said. You can't always predict every twist and turn of them. The storm with no name. The forerunner of the NWS, the U.S. Weather Bureau, was created in 1890, but weather forecasters back then were not allowed to say naughty seven-letter words like tornado. There was a policy that prohibited us from the use of that word in forecasts over fears it would cause public panic, said Albano. As more knowledge was gained about these twisted furies of Mother Nature, the storm that dare not speak its name was finally allowed to be identified when the federal government lifted the ban in 1950. However, back in the days when tornadoes were still the storm with no name and could strike without warning, the strongest recorded to hit Illinois was the tri-state tornado of March 18, 1925. It smashed into the land of Lincoln with wind speeds of more than 200 miles per hour and left a 219-mile path of destruction across Illinois, Missouri, and Indiana, taking 695 lives, leaving 2,000 injured, and crunching 15,000 homes. The next story by Tony Reed, under the section Health, is titled School Renews Injunction on HBHC. Behavioral Health Center Ramps Up PR Campaign. Indicator. Feelings are running high at St. Teresa High School pushes on with its legal effort to block plans by the Heritage Behavioral Health Center to become its new neighbor. HBHC's president and CEO, Mary Garrison, told the Herald and Review Thursday, "We continue to be dismayed by the ongoing legal actions by St. Teresa. The filed amendment persists with inaccurate information regarding Heritage's services and the individuals we serve, all while creating a framework of fear and stigma across our community about our essential work." Garrison was reacting to an amended complaint filed June 16th in Macon County Circuit Court by the Catholic school. It seeks an injunction to block HBHC's planned redevelopment of the defunct Northgate Mall and its new home next door to the school's campus at 2700 North Water Street. St. Teresa claims HBHC's clientele of patients with the histories of drug abuse and criminality will put its students in danger, and it says panicked, fee-paying parents are threatening to pull their kids out and financially cripple the private school. Garrison insists HBHC's patient pose no enhanced threat to the school, and her organization just wants to get on with the job of helping people in need. Heritage is committed to access to care for all, focusing on providing vital services to many individuals and families across our community to help them achieve optimal health and recovery, addressing mental health, substance use, and primary needs, she said. Once renovated, our Northgate campus location will allow us to ensure access to care for all the years to come, focusing on our mission to improve the mental and physical well-being of those we serve and to advance behavioral health in the community. HBHC is ramping up its public relations campaign with a series of open houses at the Northgate site at 2800 North Water Street. The Stronger Together Heritage Building Project Update Series events will be hosted from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Tuesday, June 24th, and from 3 to 5 p.m. on Wednesday, June 25th, and 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, June 28th, to show off its plans for the site. A news release from Garrison and the identical events will enable HBHC to give the public the inside scoop on how we plan to turn Northgate into a one-stop shop for addressing the mental health, substance use, and primary care needs in the community. She said the events will discuss timelines and blueprints for more than 43 $1 million renovation project. And we are also happy to provide clarification on any questions you may have about our relocation to Northgate Plaza and the services we provide. St. Teresa, meanwhile, says it has all of the clarification it needs to conclude that having HBHC as its neighbor to the north of its 112-year-old campus poses an existential threat to the school's existence. An earlier court filing by the school on the road to seeking an injunction was rejected in May by Judge Phoebe Bowers. She said the school claims of safety threats and financial ruin were vague, conclusory, and speculative, and without factual support. She left the door open, however, for the school to come back with fresh ammunition to back its claims, and it's done that with a newly filed amended complaint in the push for an injunction. Decatur attorney Gerald H. Stocks, representing St. Teresa, backs up the new legal filing with a commissioned survey of parents by a third-party marketing firm. The survey asked parents and guardians to validate the threat to St. Teresa and feeder elementary school families from the HBHC move. Results from the survey showed more than 74% of responding families said the arrival of HBHC would negatively impact their decision to send their children to St. Teresa, according to results released by Stocks. Ken Hendrickson, the executive director of the St. Teresa Educational Foundation, told the Herald and Review that 500 surveys were emailed and 400 responses came back. Those responses also indicated close to 17% of parents would definitely not send their children to the school if HBHC makes its move, representing a loss of $320,000 in revenue. Another 24% said they would be less likely to enroll, and more than 33% said they would consider enrolling their kids only if major security investments were made without raising tuition. "We've heard from parents since day one of their extreme concern," Hendrickson said. "We recognize there is a need for behavioral health services in our community, but it's about the impact this specific location choice would have on the safety of our students and the financial viability of St. Teresa." Stocks, in his legal filing, claims there is a history of trouble and violence already associated with HBHC's current location in downtown Decatur. He said the school is left with an absolute obligation to protect students, but it can't afford drastic measures like hiring security guards, which would, he estimates, would cost $292,000 a year. At current enrollment levels of 210 students at $9,000 tuition, including fees per student, the gross collected yields an operating loss approximating $250,000 per academic year, Stocks tells the judge in his legal documents. Endowment and donor contributions have been filling the deficit. St. Teresa High School cannot afford the additional $292,000 operating expenses for security guards and continue to operate. Stocks also estimates new fencing, hardening of security doors, installation of surveillance cameras, and other security enhancements would add another $250,000 to the bill, which exceeds available endowment funds or other reserves for capital improvements, the attorney added. The HBHC intended location to Northgate Mall exacts a financial burden that St. Teresa School simply cannot meet. Stock said the cost of persuading parents not to quit and the monetary strain of losing those who do will effectively cripple this premier education institution. Publicly funded education options for most students residing within the city of Decatur fail to meet established standards for academic performance and achievement and present threats to student safety that incite concern from parents and reduce achievement, he said. Historically, St. Teresa High School performed its mission with academic achievement and student safety protected. No new court hearing date for the school's amended complaint has been set yet. Donette Beckett writes that a dog has died in a house fire on Boyd Street. A dog died in an early morning fire on Thursday in Decatur. According to a press release issued by Decatur Fire Department Deputy Chief Toby Jackson, crews were called at approximately 3:30 a.m. to 446 South Boyd Street in Decatur in reference to a structure fire. Crews arrived on the scene to find a 1.5-story wood frame with heavy fire showing from the second-story windows. The initial crew used a transitional attack to knock down the bulk of the fire, Jackson stated. Search efforts located two dogs, one of which later succumbed to its injuries. The Decatur Fire Department, fire investigators, and Office of the State Field Fire Marshal are investigating the incident. Crews were also assisted by Abbott EMS, Ameren, Illinois, and Macon County Animal Control. A follow-up story, sort of, to the St. Teresa HBHC conflict is a story by Meredith Howard on parenting. When can kids be left home alone? In Belleville. As Illinois schools are out for the summer and parents consider if and when to leave their children home alone for any period of time, state law and best practices both likely factor into the decision-making process. The average cost of child care in Illinois is more than $16,000 per year for an infant or toddler in center-based care, according to nonprofit Child Care Aware of America, a figure that is unaffordable for many families. Because the cost of child care is so high, parents and guardians may be wondering when it's permissible to leave their child at home alone. Illinois state law considers a variety of factors in determining when a child may lawfully be left home alone, and in addition to legal considerations, caregivers may also want to consider the child's maturity level, independence, and more. Here's what to know about Illinois state laws regulating leaving children home alone, as well as best practices and safety tips. When can Illinois parents leave their children home alone? The short answer is, it depends on the situation. There is no specific age where an Illinois child can be left alone without any other considerations, though age is a factor. Illinois law considers a child's maturity, the specific circumstances, the length of time they'll be left alone, and other factors to determine the legality of the child being left alone. Illinois Legal Aid Online Deputy Director Gwen Daniels said in a June 6 interview with the News Democrat, "There's a common misconception that Illinois law mandates a minimum age of 14 for a child to be left home alone," Daniels said. "The Illinois Child Endangerment Act says a parent or guardian may not leave a child 6 years or younger unattended in a car for more than 10 minutes. This may be child endangerment depending on the circumstances," the Illinois Legal Aid Online website says. Unattended means that the child is not with someone who is at least 14 years old. It can also mean that the child is out of that person's sight. Child endangerment is a Class A misdemeanor in Illinois and can carry a sentence of up to 1 year in jail and up to $2,500 in fines. If an offense is considered child neglect, it's considered a Class 4 felony and carries a sentence of 1 to 3 years on the first offense, Daniel said. Another Illinois law regulating children being left home alone specifically forbids allowing a child to engage in independent activities that are unreasonable under the circumstances or for an unreasonable amount of time, Illinois Legal Aid Online says. Relevant factors in determining reasonableness or the legality of leaving a child home alone include the child's age, the number of children left home alone, whether the child has a disability or a need for ongoing medical treatment, the duration of time a child is left home alone, the safety of the location where the child is left, and whether the child is capable of making an emergency call, Daniel said. This is not an exhaustive list. Illinois legislators filed a bill in 2021 that, among other things, would provide that a neglected minor includes any minor, rather than a minor under 14 years old, whose parent or other person responsible for the minor's welfare leaves the minor without supervision for an unreasonable period of time without regard for the mental or physical health, safety, or welfare of that minor. That bill died in 2023, however. Best practices when leaving children home alone. When a child's age is not the only relevant factor in determining their readiness to be home alone, ideally children would be in upper elementary or middle school before being home alone, Rebecca Schwartz, assistant professor at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville Department of Teaching and Learning in the School of Education, Health, and Human Behavior, said in a June 5th interview with the BND. Younger children may not have the cognitive ability to keep themselves safe. In addition to a child's age, parents or guardians should consider a child's ability to care for their basic needs, Schwartz said. Other important factors to consider include the ability to follow directions and make safe choices, to understand what makes a choice safe, and their ability to self-inhibit when they want to experiment with something that may be unsafe. A child who's really curious about the stove and cooking but doesn't understand that they shouldn't be doing that when they're alone shouldn't be left home alone, said Schwartz. When evaluating what duration of time might be reasonable to leave their child home alone, a parent or guardian should also consider the social context or whether helpful neighbors or siblings might be around. The other thing I think that's important to consider is whether the child feels themselves to be ready to be home alone, Schwartz said. If a child is afraid to be home alone, it's probably not a good idea to leave them home alone, even if they generally follow the rules and make safe choices, Schwartz continued. To prepare a child before leaving them home alone, it's a good idea to talk through different scenarios, practice making phone calls to a parent or neighbor, and be sure they know how to dial 911 in case of an emergency. Since many homes no longer have landlines, caregivers should make sure the children have some way to make phone calls, said Schwartz. It may also be a good idea to post directions in case of an emergency and emergency contacts on the fridge. And turning back to the weather and the incoming heat, Isabella O'Malley of the Associated Press writes, "Heat dome to blanket millions." Summer will make a dramatic entrance in the U.S. this week with a heat dome that will bring stifling temperatures and uncomfortable humidity to millions. The heat will be particularly worrisome this weekend across wide stretches of Nebraska, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Iowa, where forecasters warn of extreme temperature impacts. This will be the first stretch of true summertime weather for many from Midwest to East Coast, said Tom Kynes, a meteorologist at the private weather company AccuWeather. A lot of those folks have been saying, "Where's summer?" Well, buckle up, because it's coming, said Kynes. The humid conditions will make places that exceed 90 degrees Fahrenheit feel as much as 20 degrees hotter, said Kynes. Heat dome forming. A heat dome occurs when a large area of high pressure in the upper atmosphere acts as a reservoir that traps heat and humidity, said Ricky Castro, a National Weather Service meteorologist in Illinois. According to the NWS Weather Prediction Center, daytime temperatures will be in the 90s Fahrenheit, and overnight temperatures will only drop to the mid-70s Fahrenheit from the Great Lakes to the East Coast during the heat wave that's expected to last into next week. Moisture blown northward from the Gulf of Mexico is fueling the muggy weather, said Jacob Asherman, a Weather Prediction Center meteorologist. This influx of moisture is fairly typical during late spring and summer, he said. The heat will be widespread into next week. On Friday, Denver could reach 100 degrees Fahrenheit, according to the Weather Service. Chicago temperatures could reach 96 degrees on Sunday. On Tuesday, Washington, D.C. could see a high of 99 degrees, and New York Central Park could reach 96. Several states in the Midwest could see dangerous temperature impacts over the weekend, according to a Weather Service measure that rates the risk from 0 to 4. Parts of Nebraska and Kansas will be in the highest category on the scale on Saturday, meaning that anyone without effective cooling or sufficient hydration could face health risks. On Sunday, Iowa, Wisconsin, Missouri, and Illinois also see a Category 4 rating. High humidity. Humidity is the amount of water vapor in the air, and the heat index is what the temperature feels like when the humidity outside is factored in, according to the Weather Service. When humans sweat, it cools the body down because it absorbs and removes heat as it evaporates off the skin. The air is saturated with water on humid days, which makes it harder for sweat to evaporate. Hot and humid days can be dangerous when the body is unable to cool itself off and can exacerbate health conditions and even lead to heat stroke. Minimizing direct sun exposure, wearing loose and light-colored clothing, staying hydrated, and spending time in air-conditioned spaces are ways to cool down during extreme heat, according to the NWS. Some parts of the U.S., such as Phoenix, Arizona, are famously hot without the mugginess. Phoenix and nearby desert regions experience this dry heat due to being located far away from large water bodies, mountains that block moist air masses, and weather patterns that bring scarce precipitation. Sweat evaporates faster in dry climates compared to humid ones. This can be dangerous because of it's easy to underestimate how dehydrated you are, according to Johns Hopkins University and Johns Hopkins Health System. In places such as Iowa, crops can affect humidity in summer months. Plants feel the effect of hot weather, and some people in the Midwest are familiar with the corn sweats, which is when crops move water to their leaves and other surfaces so it can evaporate, according to the Ohio State University. Madison County, Iowa farmer Ryan Marquardt said the corn sweat is not as bad as a sauna, but it definitely would have a sauna effect. It's humid in a cornfield, so if you're going to sweat, it's humid in a cornfield, so you are going to sweat. Cornfield contribution to the overall humidity are much lower compared to the humidity winds carry from the Gulf, according to OSU. Here's a few notes from the editorial section titled Thumbs Up. Thumbs up to Juneteenth. Thursday marked Freedom Day in the U.S., and throughout June, Central Illinois has taken to celebrating the day. News finally spread to all corners of the U.S. that the Civil War had ended and the enslaved people were free in 1865. The parties have already been underway to mark this federal holiday, and they continue this weekend. Decatur's Emancipation Parade steps off at noon Saturday, followed by a celebration at Central Park. Bloomington's annual celebration is also Saturday, taking up residence at Miller Park for a day of good food, music, and community. Champaign is celebrating Saturday also at Douglas Park with dance performances and live music, family activities, and of course a spades tournament. And Mattoon is hosting a festival Saturday afternoon at Peterson Park featuring a poetry jam and bouncy house. The celebrations continue in just about every city across the region this weekend and into next week, giving communities a beautiful opportunity to come together for some fun. Thumbs up to renovations. The businesses in University Village in Charleston have drawn renewed attention since Spyglass Properties, the retail center's new owner, has been working to reinvest in the community and redevelop the property. University Village is home to positively 4th Street Records, Rock Paper Scissors Salon, Siam Thai, Ike's Bar and Grill, and a new Huck's Gas Station, complete with Godfather's Pizza Express. The area has also seen recent developments in the Kirshner Building Center's corporate headquarters, Davis Houck Mechanical's branch location, Sarah Bush Lincoln's Lincoln Avenue Building, Lamman's Oil Larger Lambo Service Station with a Jersey Mike's and a new Dunkin', Insomnia Cookies, and Sonic Drive-In locations. Here's to continued growth and commitments to the community. Thumbs up to expanding access. OSF Healthcare St. Joseph Medical Center in Bloomington unveiled its new expanded intensive care unit that's nearly tripled the number of ICU beds available. This expansion is part of a multi-year plan to increase capacity at St. Joe's as the healthcare organization aims to provide more to patients closer to home, especially with decreasing access to specialists in rural areas. Thumbs up to accountability. This week, a federal judge handed down a prison sentence to the man who was the face of Illinois politics and Illinois Democrats for decades. Michael Madigan, former House Speaker, was sentenced to 7.5 years in prison and a $2.5 million fine on corruption offenses for trading legislation for favors for his friends and political allies. He was at the top for so long and garnered so much power, his fall seemed impossible. But now, at 83, federal prosecutors and U.S. District Judge John Robert Blakely have assured his actions, which include convictions on 10 counts of bribery, conspiracy, wire fraud, and other charges that involve kickbacks for his work in pushing legislation favorable to utility giant ComEd. These actions do not go unpunished. Kudos to Decatur Public Schools. In May, I had the privilege of attending the end-of-the-year talent show at Johns Hills Magnet School. I couldn't have been more proud to say we are taxpayers of the Decatur Public School System. The energy students building itself which was absolutely first class. Their talent, positive attitudes, teachers, helpers, and of course their principal, Miss Bonebreak, were all extraordinary. We are all products of the Decatur schools, as well as our sons and daughters, and would encourage each parent or care provider to visit and witness for yourself how the future community leaders are growing into young. Thanks again, DPS number 61, and everyone from the school board, down to all those that teach and care for our children. Congratulations from a 1967 SDHS graduate, Terry Mason of Decatur. That concludes part one of the Decatur Herald and Review for Friday, June 20th, 2025. This is Kim Harden, and I'll be back with you for part two in a moment.